if I'm here on time. Thank you very much, Paul.
He'll introduce it, so.
Ready? Okay, good.
General Energy.
The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We have an information meeting and a possible work session. Paul?
Mr. Chair, kind of your preference on the order, we do have five LC drafts for the committee. If you'd like to go on a work session, we could do that initially, and then we have a lottery overview, and then the small tract timber folks.
All right, let's open a work session then on bill introduction. Thank you. I checked to make sure we have a quorum, and we do. Mm-hmm. So let's do that first.
Okay.
Let me say first, and I'm sure you would say this if I didn't. In this committee, we understand that bill introduction is a courtesy, and that no one is committed to support, vote for, speak in favor of, encourage, or otherwise proceed with any bill that we might introduce in this committee, although that might not, the opposite might also be true if people so desire. Paul, why don't you go ahead and introduce the bills that we have.
Okay. Before I start, Mr. Chair, just to remind the committee that next Monday, Groundhog's Day, is the last day for bill draft requests.
I see.
So, all right. So we'll have some more bills as well that are being drafted for introduction, but we've gotten those requests in. You have five in front of you now, and they're really a wide variety of issues. The first one is on the elderly medical subtraction, or the special deduction is
2164.
The second one is 2165, which is relating to business energy tax credits, puts an overall cap on the total amount. That's a blank. The LC 1328 is relating to the real estate transfer taxes, permits counties to impose a tax for affordable housing. LC 2464 relates to the discount on property taxes. It essentially reduces the discount from 3% to 2% for early payment. And the third one is an extension of a sunset on a property tax exemption for containers, and that's LC 2130.
Cargo containers.
Cargo containers.
Okay, great. Is there a motion? Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I move that these bills be adopted in the committee.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves that draft LC 2164, 2165, 1328, 2464, 2130 introduced, thank you, as committee bills. Discussion. I don't see any. Any objections? I don't see any of those either. With that, the motion carries, and the bills will be introduced. Thank you very much. With that, we'll close the work session, open informational meeting. Paul?
Mr. Chair, we have overview, we're continuing for actually one more day before we start to get into bills. Yes, you do. And the issue is on the lottery, and Madison's going to do an overview for you of the lottery as a revenue source. And then the lottery director, Dale Penn, is here too, and he'll describe the lottery operations for you when Madison is through.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Madison Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. And today I came prepared. Carl is going to do some things, and I got awake. This is the sound effects. That's not what you were thinking about, I think.
No, but that's so nice. Thank you.
The presentation also this day would just like the other one, would have certain subliminal type of backgrounds. As you would see, the balls here are the ones that usually come out of the machine, give you the numbers. But remember, those are six, and here we come five, so you're always missing the Powerball. So, lottery, what we would like to think about it is this: winning the lottery, opening the champagne, having fun, not necessarily as a different kind of, how would we call it, the voluntary tax. But in order to talk more on in the lottery terminology, needs to have some level of understanding, so we would come to the same page. If the history of the lottery, we will cover net proceeds in traditional video transfers and other issues. So the first lottery terminology that we need to agree on is revenue of the games and other revenues such as interest and unclaimed prizes. Then what those prizes are, and then how we look at net receipts as game revenues less prizes, and then expenses of the game and operation, contingency reserves, and then come to a new definition, net proceeds. Net proceeds will be the net receipts less the expenses. So those are the two new definitions that we will have: the net receipts and net proceeds. Okay, a quick history in the lottery. Of course, the other trivia that one would come, which was the first lottery, and ever since the founding of this union and the nation, Washington and Jefferson had lottery games and all these kind of things. But we're not going to go through this. We'll go through the Oregon lottery. The history of the Oregon lottery that was established in 1984 by initiative petition. It started with traditional games, and the net proceeds were dedicated to economic development. Now, in 89, by legislation, we created the Sports Action. The Sports Action was at that time, it authorized video lottery, but it was suspended by the governor. In 1991, another legislative action implemented video lottery and in the same time prohibited private lotteries. And it dedicated 2.5% of net receipts at that time to counties. Now, these are net receipts, not net proceeds. In 95, Measure 21 added the financing of public education as an allowable use for the lottery. This is in addition to the economic development that was originally the intent for the lottery. Also gave the lottery bonds the first claim on revenue and dedicated 15% of net proceeds to the Education Endowment Fund. The Education Endowment Fund is the predecessor of the Education Stability Fund that we will see in a few minutes. In 98, the initiative petition of Measure 66 dedicated 15% of the net proceeds to parks, beaches, watersheds, protection, and so on. To continue with that, in 1999, legislative action dedicated not less than 1% of the video net proceeds to problem gambling. In 2002, the third special session by legislative referral, it converted the Education Endowment Fund to the Education Stability Fund. And in that sense, it dedicated 18% of lottery proceeds to the Education Stability Fund versus 18 in the previous one, and made the cap of that Education Stability Fund to be 5% of the general fund. When it reaches the 5% of the general fund, it goes down to a 15% dedication that starts filling up the now empty school capital matching sub-account. We were expecting this limit, the 5% of the general fund, to be reached in the coming biennium. Of course, that with the conditions that we have, that we might basically draw a little bit out of the Education Stability Fund, might not be the case. So, and also, it puts the condition of how it allows the withdrawal from the Education Stability Fund. It's 3/5 vote after certain economic conditions or an emergency occur. Finally, in 2005, I think some of you were even here and discussed this change. By legislative action, it repealed the sports action games, and the sports action games and the scoreboard are games that used to bet on sports action, and had also it was dedicated to college athletics. However, it became an issue with the NCAA and other athletic associations that was preventing any events from occurring in Oregon. The repeal of the sports action and the like games, although they were very unique in the nation, was in exchange for changing that blacklist, if you will, blacklisted events kind of. In the same time, it dedicated 1% of net proceeds to the college athletic programs. That 1% seemed to be how would you say it? A very good exchange from the sports action to the 1%. It basically exchanged about $3.5-4 million to about $12-13 million a year. So the college athletic program came out a net winner on this process. So if we're done with the quick history. The traditional lottery games in 07, 08, just to take a general look at the net receipts, this is how they divide as a pie chart. And if you could see, the instant tickets are about 34% of the total. One would not intuitively expect that. You'd expect the megabucks to... and traditional games, of course, are the ones that are not video games. Everything but video. You'd expect megabucks to make a lot bigger percentage. It's only 10%, and this is the Powerball, the multi-state lottery, 24%. So you would see that the lion's share, if you will, well, it's not that lioness, but... I finally made it work. So we don't. I brought this just in case. Here's some more. Okay. Well, finally, since it works, traditional game revenue. This is in how it actually comes out when you look at it in three different. Segmentation, if you see the net revenue amounts and then prizes, and the red segments are the expenses. This is for traditional and video throughout this presentation and throughout the discussion of the lottery. You'll always find those distinctions between the traditional games and the video lottery. Video lottery, as you would see in a few minutes, comes to dwarf anything that came before. So if you look at it in percentage terms, you would see the trend would be revenues kind of coming down, or the envelope is, and expenses are basically the same. Prizes are expanding a little bit.
Mr. Chair,
Yes, Representative Berger.
As a family tradition on the scratch-it tickets, when we play games, that's what you win, and I can guarantee you that is not the trend in my household.
Thank you, Representative.
Sure.
Representative Bailey.
If you could go back to that slide for just one quick second. Thank you. I'm just trying to understand a little bit here. So it's the share of 100% by year, right? So does that mean that the prizes are expanding, or does that mean that the overall share of that 100%, that the size of the total 100% is going down so that the proportional share of prizes and expenses is getting larger, shrinking net revenues?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, the net revenues themselves are getting smaller in percentage of the total of the 100%, as you were saying. The percentage of prizes is going up. So, and that represents actually certain decisions and actions that are done in order to make that. The green background represents the difference with the video lottery. Because remember, that's a lot more money. That wasn't that exciting. But the amount of money that comes with the video lottery is, as I mentioned before, kind of dwarfs all the traditional games. And when we started it in 91-92, you look at this total, and this the lottery, and Dale Penn would not like me to use these figures, but the way these are used, think of them, this is about $12 billion. And why this huge number? This represents all the money that is in the machine, gets to be a prize, played again, and continues. So this is a total, everything that would have ever been played inside the machine, whether it's money or winnings. So if you think about that, that is a truly a large number still.
Representative Berger.
As in, by video lottery, you include traditional poker and line games in this graph?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that is correct. You would see that and this time the increase that starts coming for the line games.
Thank you.
Coming in. But video lottery will include both. It's anything that you sit down on the machine and you basically play, whether it's a Vegas style kind of thing.
I just want to make certain that I understand. If someone were to sit down at a machine with $100 and play continuously until the money was gone over some period of time, that might represent a couple thousand dollars of this number.
That is
because of the
churn.
Of the churn.
Right.
All right. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And in that sense, that $100 might win another 50 and another 100 and so on. That's why you would find that
right.
Prizes.
Which is why it takes a couple of hours to put it all in the machine.
Well, in the one or three, two times that it didn't take me 2 hours at all. It was a lot more efficient, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Well, efficiency is a useful thing.
And you see that the amount of red segment of the bar, this that represents expenses, gets to be very, very small when it comes to the video lottery revenues. Likewise, the net revenue is also small. However, this represents, because of the standing number of dollars, represents a very large number, and this is where the percentages come in. So you are talking about something in the neighborhood of about 90 93% of the total being in prizes. So every dollar in the churn that is played, 92 cents are paid in prizes.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But of course, for the people listening at home, that doesn't mean they're going to get a 92 or 93% return on their investment in the slot machine. Ultimately, if they keep playing, they will lose and we will get their money.
President Gelser, as they said, it's not for investment purposes. but in the same, you're right. In that, if you come in with $100 or a dollar and put it in the machine, does not mean you're going to leave with 92 cents. It means that if you play a dollar, you win $2, and then you're going to lose four more. And so on. In total, the estimated percentages between your winning and your losses is about 92%. And in that sense, you also look at the percentage of expenses. As I said, it gets really small, and it gets smaller as the amount of dollars gets larger. The net revenue, this is what makes all this money that comes in, is represents about 8% of this total. So if you put them both together, traditional and video, you would have something that looks this way, and you could see where lottery was when it was traditional games and how it took a quick jump with video lottery and just kept going on. This is, and you would see in a few minutes how this happened. And then just the trend just keeps going up. This is the introduction of the line games. That's the kind of jump that you started looking at. In percentage terms, this is also an interesting way of looking at. This is how net revenue was, and then you would see how it is going down. However, just because it is going down as percentage, it actually is a lot more in amount of dollars because of the number of dollars that are being considered into this whole game is a lot more. And then the net revenue, although it becomes really small in percentages here, it actually is by far many folds more than it is. But it just the amounts that are being excluded. And the envelope also looks this way too. So if you try to understand it in percentage terms, this is how it looks. So the lottery transfers are the amounts that ends up being transferred to the different programs, different agencies, and different uses. This is how these transfers look. This is after everything is paid, all the expenses, all the commissions. Everything is done with, and those are the amounts that we send to the different either dedicated uses, which are these different colored segments of the bar, or what we call the balance. The balance are the amounts that are open for the legislature to be using in different appropriation or different uses. And although this is very flexible amounts or flexible amounts of dollars, they are still governed by the constitutional restriction of either being economic development, education, or watershed and parks enhancement. So these are the allowable uses. But that's, as of course you know, education and seems to be the one that takes a lot of the... and just... show you this 1%, the small one, not the small one. This includes the 1% for the college athletics and the problem gambling and so on. But you could see how small that comes And these are millions of dollars. So you're looking about $650 million in discretionary amounts. Lottery distribution, just to put them down on paper, if you will. First thing comes out is the lottery bonds. They take first precedence out of the revenue. 2.5% of video net receipts are dedicated to county economic development. This goes before anything else. It goes to counties for their economic development programs. The 18% for educational stability fund. This is again the 5% general fund limit and so on. 15% to parks and recreation. And that also is dedicated to be half or 50% of that to parks and half to maintenance of the habitat of fish and wildlife. So that also has a certain level of restrictions on it. Now that that is also goes away in 2013. Then you have the 1% to the college athletics, 1% to the minimum gambling, 1% to the county fairs, and then the rest is, of course, legislative allocation for the year.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Nathan. Could you explain to me one more time why we give 1% to college athletics that have their own revenue-generating options as opposed to college core programs and investing in a workforce rather than football?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I think this... This has, a long history of how it happened. As we were saying, first it started with the college, with the sports gambling. And as it went away, the college athletics got, I think the discussion at one time was like to have 0.5%, but then it ended up 1%. However, that these programs are not necessarily only all the football games and the other games that actually get all the attention. Most of this college athletic, if I understand it correctly, and that might be a different side when it comes to the spending side. Of course, when we bring it in as revenue and look at it, it's good. But when they spend it out there in the other committee, that becomes a different issue.
May I
of course. Yes, Representative Gelser.
Where would we change this? Would that be revenue, or would that be... It just strikes me as odd that we have a dedicated funding source for college athletics when we do not have one for all the other things that we've talked about that I would argue are more important. And I think certainly living in a university community, it becomes very frustrating for my constituents to see huge investments in enormous stadiums, whether they be football or basketball and training facilities, when those same students don't have maps in their history classes and they see kids losing stuff in their public schools. So that just really
Let's ask the first question. Which of these are constitutionally mandated and which ones are statutory, if you know?
Mr. Chair. The 1% college athletic is something that is only in the statutes. So is the 1% problem gambling and this 1%. So that percentage could definitely be changed or fixed or increased depending on how things defined to be the right use. However, there's about 50% here that is still open for any legislative dedication or any legislative intent that could be allocated anywhere. Some of that could be dedicated, and it does not have to be a constitutional dedication. It could be a statutory dedication, just like the 1% and so.
Well, I think then, Representative, that the answer to your question is that the legislature could change that by statute if we chose to do that. And there's still a few days before Groundhog Day.
Indeed, I know what I'm doing this afternoon.
Thank you, Madison. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, the background changes again. That's a sound of money, all right. This is lottery distribution. It gets to be in the 2009-11 as the forecast or the budget is on $1.4 billion. I remember when we were starting to look at the lottery, I think Paul, when he was a state economist, first took this issue of forecasting the lottery, and I went along and attended this meeting. We're talking about a lot smaller numbers than this. This is a huge number. However, of course, you would preface all this discussion that although this is what we're having in the forecast, it might not be all that might come in. However, so far, as Director Penn would say, they will come very close to the amounts in 07, 09. However, the amounts in 2009-11, that remains to be seen. But if you look at it, it is, by any stretch of the imagination, is a big number. $1.4 billion coming to the state out of lottery is significant. And this is the discussion we were just having a few minutes ago, but 53.4% is open for legislative appropriation. The bonds take about 11.8. That will increase after this biennium because you have, I guess, in front of you in this coming few days, about $50 million in lottery bonds. Part of this economic stimulus package, the bonds that are being discussed, then if the governors go with the Connect Oregon 3, for example, just like it was Connect Oregon 1 and 2, which was $100 million each in lottery bonds, that percentage might go slightly more than that. And, of course, in a few days, you'll also get the Commission on Debt report, which sets the limit of how much the amount of bonding that is advisable under the amount of revenue that comes in. Education Stability Fund, if you put all these things together, gets to maybe about 14.8. Parks and Recreation. And why is this not 18% and this is 15% and so on? Because there are things that come first and take. And this picture is of total versus what comes and takes priority and then goes to the different uses accordingly. So issues that usually we look at when we are discussing the lottery is the line games, of course, that these are the new introduction that's in 2005. The video payout percentages, those are the commission rates that always generate discussions every time that happens. Retailer compensations, lottery expenses. Of course, the smoking ban. Now, this is a new thing that comes in. What happened lately is what we call the perfect storm, is the snow and the freeze that happened between, when did it happen? December 21st or 20th. And then after that, immediately or during that time, the unfolding of the economic meltdown. But it's an interesting coincidence that you would have snow and freeze and a meltdown in the same sentence, which has the effect of making trivialize the ban, the smoking ban, that is.
It does make it much more difficult for you to actually figure out what the effect of the ban is, doesn't it?
That's
because there are these other confounding effects that move things in the same direction.
That's precisely true, Mr. Chair, and we will talk about this even a little more.
I'm sure your colleagues in other states are very disappointed about not being able to use Oregon as a way of understanding how those kind of bans work because of these other effects.
They will. Yes, they will. Just to talk about the line games, Mr. Chair, and again I bring your attention to the change in the background. That didn't sound right. Let me try this again. You cannot hear it. Explosive growth. There is an explosion in the background.
Oh, well.
It's not working. But I tried, Representative Bilser. If you look at how it was in 03-05 at 131.1 million, that's an increase of 13.5. Remember, the introduction of the line games came in at the end of this biennium, so it wasn't reflecting how much growth there was. And then you had 2005-07, 460 million. That's 41.4% growth increase. That is an astounding amount. We always said about the smoking, it was a 30% growth. Is how long is that going to go? I mean, that was an unbelievable. Now, remember, this is through a biennium. So when we were looking at this quarterly or at different months, this was going and going, and it was like the was that funny thing? Of course, in 2007-09, and this is still, we're still living in this biennium, and it still shows 15.4% increase. This is a measure, a different measure. This is the dollars in. This is the actual dollars that are put in the machine versus the total number of money that we were talking about before is with churns and replayed again. This is the money that gets out of the pockets into the machine. And if you look at that, you see the levels of growth that came with that. Then in the 2009, we really are starting to have questions about how much growth we will see. And we will look at that a little more later. The video, the percentage of makes out of total revenue prizes, you would see how this is when it started at one time. It started growing and it went back up again, and this is all the amounts. At the highest percentage it was 93.86, and then with the introduction of the line games, the percentage is coming back down towards the 92%. This is okay. If you look at it in a different way of looking at things, as an annual growth, and the prizes have not grown that much. Gross amounts have grown and went through real strong, quick growth here, and then it started coming down and going this way again. And the net is where you find all the growth that is coming. The net, remember all the percentages that we saw small, but this is, look at how the net is and still growing with very large percentages. And that is the story, the success of the Oregon Lottery, is how they're bringing net revenue into the state that is coming in from the net kind of discussion. So the compensation rates, I'm going to go quickly over this. These are how the old rates used to be. Was good living to get 30% of the lottery for the So 25% at lower percentage total is you get an average of 32%. That is sweet. In 2004, with poker only, these were changed to different way of looking at things, with two different structures and choice, and then it became about 28% to 29%. That's the overall blended rate. And of course, it changed again. After 2005, poker and line games. The rates were also at different tier options, 4 and 3, and they started looking at estimated overall blended rate of 22 to 26. Finally, in 2007, there is the look back provision, if you will, that was part of the agreement. It says if you get or exceed 850,000, there is a different way of looking at the rates. We start bringing them down, and they change again, because this is something based on something we did not anticipate. And if it becomes true, this is where the 21% to 25% comes in. Now, the whole discussion, there's always a contentious discussion on about the retailer compensation, why and why not. And one view of the revenue, as again, always the discussion says, since we're always going to get this amount of gross revenue coming in, the however percentage you start paying the retailers, you're basically taking away from the gross revenue, and net revenue keeps going down. So the more expense, if you will, to the retailers, the less net revenue comes in. However, the other more business-oriented, if you will, type of discussion says, revenue is not always constant. Revenue is a function of how much the retailers put into it. They start advertising. They bring in the customers. We're actually the ones that are generating the business. So the more incentive there is, if you will, with the percentage, the higher the growth would be of your revenue. So that's where the discussion comes in. One side says, oh, no, you're taking all the money. The other side says, oh, well, without me being given a good incentive, I'm not bringing the money. But if you look at them from a different point of view, if you put these two graphs together, you got the economist kind of dream here. You have an intersecting lines. Intersecting lines means supply and demand are aligned. Life is good, ISLM. They all come in. This is where things become meaningful. But nobody really knows where this percentage is. We tried to see, if it was an easy thing to do, we would have told you this a long time ago, but we keep trying, of course, and that's where the percentage of compensation comes in, and we try to measure exactly where that intersection line is, just to emphasize the point. Okay, final things would have been, if you look at expenses, that's always also a discussion point with lottery. How much remember, the lottery as an agency does not necessarily go through the same process as every other agency does. It has a constitutional kind of exemption to work their own budgets with overview rather than complete limitations and so on. But the expenses are always looked at, and those expenses would be for the whole lottery as it was before 91, before the introduction of video. Once you introduced video, if you want to split them both, you look at the traditional games. Traditional games, by the way, are dedicated are defined not to exceed 16%. So it cannot exceed 16% of the traditional lotteries in expense amounts. And it seems to be the case. It's about hovering about 16%. So it is complying with what whatever it is. And then you introduce video, and the percentage just plummets. And it keeps going down because, of course, the amount of revenue keeps going up. You put the two together, I mean, that's the total. That's a video. So when you put them together, it just goes up a little bit. And after this, you can't see anything. So it's all red ink after that. Right? We would have stopped here at other times. But unfortunately, the dark clouds and the trees. So what is happening this year? We used to talk about a smoking ban. Smoking ban, however, if you remember the discussions we had about the smoking ban, we thought there will be a level of impact on lottery. Thought most of the impact is in tobacco revenue, but some level of impact on lottery. Level of impact, we thought they'll take about 1 to 2% as we study it, 1 to 2% decrease of the growth rate. But remember that time, when we were discussing this in 2007, lottery was actually growing by 30%, 32%, 35%. So if growth comes at 28%, who's going to notice? who's going to even make this percentage comes out of the smoking ban, and it was during time of transition, and it wasn't necessarily clear or been able to take it out. But we always maintained, and if you go back to our revenue impact statement at the time, we always maintained that it'll be about that percentage. So that percentage comes to about $7.5 to $15 million a year. We've always thought this would be part of the smoking ban effect. Now, so what's happening also this year? So the perfect storm we have, the snow and the freeze and the economic meltdown, this will put the smoking ban or mask the effect from the other side. I mean, we were thinking about who's going to notice when it's 28% increase on the positive. Now, we think the economic meltdown and the snow freeze will make it hard to distinguish on the other side. So, if you have 2 weeks of the storm, the snow and the freeze, as we asked Larry and got some numbers from them, this made about 8.1 million below December forecast. Now, remember, December forecast gets in actuals up to about October. So this is 24.5% below December forecast. If you look at September forecast, which has more forecast numbers and less actuals, it's about 9.4 million below 27. This is only from the effect of the time of the 2 weeks lockdown, if you will, of the snow and the freeze. Economic conditions. Also, you can look at this. About compare it to last year's. If you compare this year with the last year, and you compare the amounts that about 29 weeks or so that we have actuals for with the 29 weeks of the previous year, you're looking about $212 million below of what lottery is. That's about 31.6%.
Now, are we talking about an actual decline in revenue or something else?
Yes, sir. This is an actual less than previous year. Now, 212 million out of 800 million is, I mean, it's 31%. But that does not mean we will end up that way, because we usually make up all that snow and ice. But if a lot of this stays as part of the economic conditions, and not only the snow and ice, and that's where all the things came in the same time and kind of prevented us from a clearer way of looking at things. You have the economic conditions, you have the snow storm and the meltdown and the ice, and you have the smoking ban. All of this, you cannot sift out the effects of the different things on lottery. And with that dark background,
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Muzzin, is there any indication that there's any kind of competition between tribal casinos and the state lottery?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Bailey, there is always this competition. It's not necessarily one-to-one or establishment-to-establishment. But in this whole atmosphere, there is this competition. The first time I remember, and Paul was also there at that time, forecasting for the lottery. The first time we saw a decrease in the lottery was with the opening of the Spirit Mountain Casino, right? Yep. That was the first time we ever saw a decrease in lottery growth. And at that time, and the lottery always comes up with, Dale Penn, the director, would tell you that they always come up with new inventions, new games, new staying new. At that time also, they increased the winning percentage in order to attract. So that competition, that underlying competition, is always there. It's just who establishes in which niche, and who would be more preferable to players who come in your neighborhood kind of, the tavern or versus driving to the...
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So then I assume the same would also apply to online gambling or other ways that individuals could choose to gamble. And if that's the case, are we seeing a growth in any of those other avenues for gambling over time? Could that be affecting some of the lottery revenues as well?
Vice Chair Bailey, I think that is always assumed. There are certain places where we expect competition to come even more. Across the borders in Washington, there is expected to open a new casino on, I think, exit 16, La Center. That would present a new competition. Now, this is very close to... Because the amounts of gambling dollars, contrary to popular belief, are probably very limited. And they take percentage of disposable income. And even in the forecast, when we sit on the forecast committee to forecast lottery dollars, we assume the growth and the same level of the growth of disposable income. So that segment of disposable income that is going to gambling, although it was growing quickly at one point, it stabilizes after the time. And we think it's a stable time that it's not grow by much. So if it doesn't go here, it's there's so many ways you could slice the pie. And the competition definitely makes an impact.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Isn't there a difference, though, in the gaming experience that people look for with destination gaming, whether that be a casino like Spirit Mountain or traveling to Las Vegas or Reno, being a different clientele looking for a different type of experience than the person that goes to a tavern or buys a ticket or does a line game at a local convenience store?
So, yes, it does. And for a long time, unfortunately, we used to say this theory about the percentage of the disposable income being fixed a long time ago, and we changed it for a while. We used to say, oh, these new games and these small casinos here are actually the training ground for when people go to Vegas for the big bang, right? So they train themselves in the small one, and they go to... they step on. But you're right. There's a whole different experience. Obviously, there is a niche. There is a segmentation of market. And that segmentation of market is not necessarily in a way that it is so rigid that the players in the market, one market, do not go to the other one. There is this movement between one market and the other. However, yes, there is a certain status in it that you have this borders and it's established and the niche is there.
Can I follow up, Mr.
Well, what I'd like to note is that it's almost 9 o'clock. We have another report this morning. I'd like to hear from the director, who may be able to answer some of these questions better than our economist can. Unless it's something really burning for Mazin, I'd like to go ahead with that. Is that all right? Okay. Mazin, thank you very much for the presentation. We have access to you later, but I think we ought to hear from the director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm director of the Oregon Lottery. I didn't bring a presentation for you this morning. I was here primarily to answer questions. I would be happy to address a couple of things.
Why don't you go ahead and address the questions that have already been asked and then other issues you'd like to raise?
Yes, I think that would be good. I think both of the last couple of questions are very important to the lottery. I think that there is an equilibrium as present in Oregon at the present time. There have been a number of casinos that have been in operation for a number of years, and research tells us that there is a different kind of customer for destination resorts, and certainly Vegas and Reno and Atlantic City, that's another experience. The proposal to put a new casino just over the Oregon line, however, would change that equilibrium dramatically. It's totally out of our control. 50% of our video revenue comes out of the greater Portland area, and when you don't have to drive very far, that can have a big impact. As we have studied the opening up of casinos, we believe there's about a 20-mile radius that lottery establishments are hit very hard within 20 miles of a casino. So that's significant. Oregon, obviously those are Oregon dollars that could go to that casino in Washington. There would be absolutely no revenue generation for the state of Oregon, but that's a federal decision out of our control at this point. Let's see. I was trying to think what the other questions were. I might throw a couple of things out, though, because you being the revenue committee and you're about to address one vote on bonding here very quickly, and Mazin touched on this just briefly. Well, given this difficulty that we're in right now, certainly from the beginning of December, we have seen a tremendous hit on our revenues. Up until the beginning of December, our sales were about 2% off from the previous year. Now, that was all economy, and looking at other lotteries, looking at gaming in other locations, I saw an article recently about Nevada. They're off 9%. And so this is just the economy. Our average bet has dropped from $1.07 to 97 cents. That's all economy, and that has a tremendous impact blown out over the entire state for every bet. The snow and ice really killed us, as you saw, and the last 2 weeks of December are always low weeks for us in the Christmas holidays, and then we go immediately January 1 smoking ban. And now it seems like we've kind of bottomed out these first 3 weeks of January at $13 million a week of video revenue as opposed to about $17 million. Now, how long this will last is very difficult. The next month will be important for us to watch. And that becomes important for you not on the stability of the lottery as a funding source, because I believe we're still a very strong funding source. It does become important about what kind of revenue is available for next biennium. Mazin put up the slide, $1.4 billion. I think at the next forecast that will drop. I don't think that given the smoking ban and the economy that we will be able to produce $1.4 billion. That will come down some. What happens this biennium, though? You're faced with the big shortfall in general fund. And that is where we have already transferred $1.165 billion this biennium. We have one more quarter to transfer. And I think we're going to be able to be very close to the $1.3 billion that you authorized last session and what those budgets are built upon for lottery funded projects. So I'm very hopeful that we can still hit that $1.3 billion this biennium, even with our sales where we are. But and so bonding authority, the ability to pay this $50 million, perhaps more transportation, Oregon Connect 3, I think that's very solid. I do think probably we're going to be somewhere in the 1.2, 1.25, 1.3 billion for next biennium, though. That's where I think you'll see that. Now, we have a lot of things on the horizon to try to increase sales here, because we did have the advantage we had 18 months notice about the smoking ban. So, as we looked at other locations, how did they grow out of the smoking ban loss of sales for gambling? And what they did is they tried to bring in new games, they tried to bring in new machines, make things new, reinvent themselves, that type of thing. And so we already developed a business plan, and we are going to change three games on each of our machines. We already changed one this month. We have another machine. We take out the three lowest producing games, bring in three new ones. And with line games, those usually generally become the top producers. But they decay over time, so you want to replace them. We have a new machine that will replace our last machine that was really designed for poker only. And so that all of our machines will be designed not only to play poker, but also to play line games. And we'll be bringing that out in April. So we think those changes will help us with the smoking ban. The problem we have is, what about the economy? Because that is impacting us. But we're trying to bring out some other games. Our raffle game started Sunday. We've almost sold a quarter of our tickets already just in the first 2 days of sales of that game. So those are the things we have on the horizon. I think the stability of the lottery is very strong, and even though you can see an AP story today talking about, gee, our sales are off, and basically what Mazen has told you, I believe that we'll come close to producing the dollars that we need for this biennium. Bonding is strong. It's just we won't hit that 1.4. That will get revised down as you go through budgets. But I don't know if there are other specific questions. I'd be happy to address them.
Yeah, Representative Bentz had something earlier, and I'm going to go to him first and then to Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Director, and Mazen. The issue, I guess, in my mind is, who is it that's actually gambling? Is it a discrete group that repeats, like smokers, or is it broad, a broader than that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, we do have a portrait of the average Oregon player, and what I will say is they're the average Oregonian. And it's about equally split between male and female, and a little bit of a college education, about a $46,000 a year income level. Age 46. Now, that's the average component. People ask us, well, is it overrepresented in the small, in the lowest income categories? And what we have seen is we're underrepresented in the lowest financial categories. We're underrepresented in the highest, but we are overrepresented in the middle. The concern that we have is that 4 years ago, if I gave you that description, it would be very similar, except the average age was 41. Now, our average age is 46. And that becomes the challenge for the lottery. How do we really make our games popular for the 20-year-olds and the 30-year-olds? Because our player is aging. And so scratch tickets and games have been around for 25, 30 years. They aren't carrying the same kind of appeal. And so that's why we're looking for new types of games to present. Now, I don't know if that addressed your question or not. I'd be happy to.
Well, it was very interesting, but it's kind of doesn't okay. quite address the question. I guess okay. what I'm really asking is, are these repeat players over and over and over again the same group? Or is it a broad cross-section? In other words, is this lottery exercise in raising revenue similar to a income tax across the board, or is it focused on one narrow demographic? That's the question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benz, I would say, first of all, probably 70% of the Oregon population plays some form of lottery game. For instance, before I went to the lottery, I played Megabucks. I had my own little formula how I'd play that, but I never played line games, never played video, that type of thing. The lion's share, though, of income does come through the video product. And how large that grouping is, I don't think I can give you a precise answer on that. It is a smaller subset, though, than the 70%, but I think it is a large group. The difficulty is, what is the economic downturn doing to that group? We've seen that the average bet has dropped, and then what happens about smoking? Anecdotally, we would hear that many of those video players smoke. And so that is why there is this readjustment that takes place. On the other hand, we believe there is a large number of people who did not go to those locations before or were at the locations but did not play the games. And so, again, I can't say what's happening because we only have 3 weeks of sales data, and right now they're down. But what we're trying to do is to bring in new people, because that is really our business plan, is we want to have a lot of people playing a little. We don't want to have a small group doing all the playing, because you're going to burn out that group and just develop problem gamblers. So we want to have as many games as possible, a lot of people playing a small amount.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since John Lim isn't here, I'm going to... ask a question about what I see is mini casinos in the malls. I see a lot of them, and I want to know what the impact, what percentage of impact those have, and what you believe would happen to the players and the revenue if those weren't there.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Riley. There, I think what you're addressing is what would be termed the deli operation. And
I wouldn't call it that, but yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
And so we, and basically the Constitution says that in the state of Oregon you cannot have a casino. Mm-hmm. And so there's been some concern that clearly a restaurant that has a substantial business for food, a tavern, substantial business for alcohol, those types of things are not the concerns. It is a business model that grew up that called themselves a deli, and they really didn't emphasize food sales. They emphasized just having the machines. And so that was a concern. And so we changed our rule, and we'd used the concept called dominant purpose, and it was a term from the Supreme Court used about what is a casino, but they didn't define it. And so what we tried to do is change our rule and say, listen, we're prohibiting casinos. And if you are a lottery retailer, you need to have a business that portrays itself, that advertises itself, that has seating space that would appear to everyone to be a deli, if that's what you want to be, a tavern, if that's what you want to be, or whatever. And so we've used that rule, and we have 10 common sense kind of observations about how do you look, how do you operate, And we've used that, not just a straight percentage of gambling versus non-gambling, because that is too easily manipulated, and I think that's what was happening with the deli operation. You could sell a particular product and say, well, I have 51% of non-gambling sales, and I have 49% gambling, and yet it looked like, and it felt like, and it operated as just really a gambling operation. So we've tried to start working on all of those locations, and we've seen tremendous changes in how they appear, how they present themselves, their menus, that type of thing. And so that's an ongoing process.
But that didn't answer my question. What you answered was, what are these places?
Yeah.
How do you see them? My question was, would it affect revenue if these places didn't exist?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Riley, if you reduced a significant portion of lottery retailers, it would have a devastating impact on income. Then it comes down to how many, and you know, that type of thing. I would estimate that probably about 20% of our retailers are in this deli type of endeavor, and certainly a large portion of them would not be susceptible to any kind of legal change. I do think that it becomes an ongoing thing to work with individuals, but so it really becomes a numbers issue. But if you look at 80% of the revenues transferred to the state of Oregon come from video, and if you take a good portion that produce a lot of revenue, and certainly some of those deli operations do produce a lot of revenue, if you say, well, somehow we're going to prevent them, now, I don't know how you do that, because then we get into some issues about this is a free country, free trade, they have a right to operate, and citizens have a right to make purchasing choices however they wish to make them. It could be a very dicey legal issue about how you would reduce it more than what I've described. But certainly, if you say we're going to cut 20 or 25% of the video retailers, it would have a dramatic impact on revenue.
And they're about 20%.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Did you have any other remarks you wanted to give us today?
No, I'm, Mr. Chair, I'm always happy if you have questions that come up during the session, or if anything I can assist on, or you see something in the news, I'd be more than happy to come back at any time or answer any questions if anyone just wished to give me a call.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. And thank you, Mazin, for your presentation this morning. Paul?
Mr. Chair, back in 2003, the Revenue Committee spent a lot of time in the small tract forest land program, establishing it, and approved House Bill 2197. And one of the requirements was that the Department of Revenue report back to you the results of that program, and they are here. John Phillips is here to discuss the kind of review of the program and at about the 5-year point.
Great, thank you. And colleagues, it looks to me like we have about 45 minutes since the House convenes at 10:15. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Phillips with the Department of Revenue. And as Paul said, we're here to talk about the Small Tract Forest Land Program and the request in the note to review the model that created the severance tax rate. And we'll talk more about that later. In front of you or in your file, you should have a copy of our report that provides a lot more detail. And if you have questions on that, we can address those when the time comes. Just by way of overview, we were asked to talk just briefly about the history, sort of a background of what has been timber taxation history in Oregon, what are the current forest land programs, what is the small tract forest land program, and why are we talking about it today, why was the request made for the model discussion, In our review, what are the results, findings, and conclusions from our study? Summarize that for you. Right around statehood, forest land and timber taxation was begun in Oregon with an annual property tax. This is going to be a severely abbreviated overview of the history of Oregon taxation on forest land, because I'm sure there's a lot more detail that we could provide, but for the relative importance for this particular presentation, we're going to try to abbreviate it. On the east side, in 61, there was added a severance tax, and you'll see down in the bottom bullet in 77, the west side received a severance tax too. And the severance tax is a tax on the harvest of the timber at the time of harvest. In 61, at the same time the east side received the severance tax, there was created a Western Oregon Small Tract Option Program, which was for certain eligible owners of smaller tracts, obviously. It removed timber from the property tax roll for this program, and the owners paid on the productivity of the land. In 93, a specially assessed forest land value was created, and the severance tax was changed to a privilege tax. I believe this was a function of the workings of a constitutional amendment regarding property tax limitations. Creating a privilege tax removed it from the limitations on that measure. The values that forest land was taxed on were reduced to 20% of the specially assessed value of forest land. In 97, you'll recall a second constitutional amendment that came into play here that reduced the specially assessed value on forest land to 90%. That should sound pretty familiar from our orientation, because all other property received a relative 90% reduction, as did then the forest land in this case. The maximum assessed value was limited to 3% growth at that time. And in 99, a new forest land program was implemented for all, phasing in 100% of the specially assessed values. The privilege tax was completely phased out from 99 to 2003, and the Western Oregon small tract option was sunset in 2003. So 2003 brings us to the beginning of our discussions about this small tract forest land program. All owners were phased into a land value tax, property tax, and including small tract, because as I mentioned, the Western small tract option tax was phased out, so all forest land owners were in the forest land tax program. And in 2003, a new program was created for the small forest land owners. The idea was that for large owners with large tracts of land, you could harvest certain tracts at certain times and you could manage your cash flow. But for small owners, and it was defined as 5,000 acres or less, you might have one stand of a certain age, of a certain quality, and your cash flow is limited to the rotation cycle, which could be 60 to 80 years. So it made it difficult to pay a tax on an annual basis, and it was more advantageous to pay at the time you had an incidence of revenue, which was at the time of harvest. The plan at that time then was to reduce for small tract forest land owners the property tax to 20% of what all other forest land owners were paying. Second point of it was that it was an option. You didn't have to go into this program, it was an option. So you could stay in the full specially assessed forest land program. Severance tax was then paid on the volume of harvest at the time of harvest. So the idea was that you pay 20% on your property tax, and then at harvest you pay what would equal the 80% that has been deferred all the years. It doesn't sound like a chainsaw. Maybe a weed whacker out there.
Hedge clipper.
There he is.
Okay. He's right outside the window.
No forest land going on. No harvesting going on, so we won't send the severance tax agents out there. This slide just describes the forest land and timber taxation in Oregon today. You've got the top square on the left is the forest land program. The only way out of that is by option, and only if you're a small tract forest land owner. So the taxation on forest land generally is a property tax at 100% of the specially assessed value and a forest products harvest tax. The forest products harvest tax is a tax that I'll describe a little bit more in depth later, but it applies to all harvested timber. The small tract forest land option is, as I said, a possibility for small tract owners to opt out of the main program, and they would pay under the regime shown there, property taxes at 20% of the specially assessed forest land, severance tax at the time of harvest with different rates for eastern and western Oregon, and finally a forest products harvest tax at the time of harvest. That forest products harvest tax is divided up into this pie here. Those rates are set by statute and go to the Forest Institute, OSU Research, Forest Practices, and the Forest Land Protection Fund. Small tract forest land severance tax distribution. And this is the plan where they opt in. They're small owners, and at the time of harvest, a tax is levied, known as the severance tax, and the taxes are paid and distributed according to this chart, which these percentages are also in statute. Were created in 2003. In terms of administration, the small tract forest land program receipts are shown in the green, with the administrative costs shown in the brown. And you can see that the revenues have been, in the last couple of years at least, in the $300,000 to $350,000 range on the harvest. And the administrative costs are roughly in the neighborhood of 29%.
Could you give us an idea of how this compares to revenues that were received before this tax went into effect?
Mr. Chair, in terms of the administrative costs?
No, the overall receipt that we got from the previous way in which the this business was taxed. Now, I think one of the points of this kind of a report is not only how this tax is functioning, but how it actually compares to our previous methods of taxation.
Mr. Chair, if I could beg a minute, we'll take a look at a chart we brought along with us.
And it may be something that you want to report to us later.
Okay.
And I think it would be helpful, given that the administrative cost is more than 20% of the entire collection, might be useful to know why that's so high, and if there are changes we might make in the program that would reduce that cost. If there are complexities in the way this is run that add to that administrative cost, that perhaps we could change some aspect of the program to reduce that cost and thus increase the net revenue, would be the kind of focus I would have for asking that question. And again, that's probably not something you can answer today.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to get back to you maybe with an answer to your first question.
Right.
And as to the second question and comment, I think that's also a useful discussion because we feel that's relatively high too. Relatively high. There are structural reasons for that in the statute.
Mm-hmm.
For example, assuming that you're a small tract forest land owner and you enter the program, it would be more advantageous to pay 20% for a long time and harvest many years later. If you were just about to harvest a large acreage of timber, you probably wouldn't want to enter the program. So what that's doing to the revenue is it's pushing the revenue off to the later years, many years down the road of the program.
So we're still collecting revenue under the alternate system from some people who will eventually use this system.
Mr. Chair, these revenues represent owners who've and acres that have elected into the small tract program. They're paying the 20%, but there are some incidental harvests going on. Maybe the lion's share of their property is younger trees.
Mm-hmm.
and they see that it's more advantageous to enter the program now, even though they'll have some incidental harvests and trees that are mature.
Okay, let me ask it again. And I think in order for the committee to get an overview of the way in which our taxation system is functioning, we need to know not only the people who have opted in, the acreage that's opted in, but also that which might opt in sometime in the future but hasn't yet, and what kind of revenues those lands are producing.
Okay.
In order to make some sense of it. I was on the committee in 2003 when we had this conversation and assurances were made about how this was going to work. I'd be very curious to find out how it actually is working. But that requires a much larger view, I think, than simply looking at the properties that have actually opted into this program to this time. Would you agree with that statement, by the way?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would.
Okay, thank you.
And
obviously that's beyond the scope of your report today.
Yes, it is. And additionally, some of this high administrative cost is a function of the way the program was created.
Right.
The necessity for returns being filed and sent and processed and tracking permits of trees that were harvested through the Forestry Department, and it has some levels of complexity that create the need for the costs.
Well, and the department might have some suggestions about things we could do in an alternate way that would reduce administrative costs without doing great violence to the program. If you had such suggestions, I think we'd like to hear them.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. And as part of the development of this study and this presentation, we've had discussions with the director of the department, and we've come to that same exact conclusion. We need to think about what recommendations we can make to you.
Thank you. Go ahead. Other questions? Thank you. Go ahead.
In terms of program participation, here's a slide that shows, sort of demonstrates the east side and the west side and total statewide owners and acres. Generally, you'll notice that about between 27 and 32% have elected in of the eligible owners. We were also required to do a study of all of the forest land acres in Oregon to determine who were eligible, and that was part of the startup costs. The severance tax model, and one of the reasons that I'm joined at the table with by Pam Overhalzer from our timber section, is because she has taken a great deal of effort to dig into the model that was created primarily by your Legislative Revenue Office staff and try to understand the assumptions that were embedded in the model and rerun the model so that we can have some kind of an evaluation as to whether our assumptions were correct and what might need to be changed. Why the model? Well, in order to recapture the 80% that's being deferred or delayed by the small tract owners, a tax rate was necessary that will capture today's dollars in the future for that 80%. And that's across all of the acres being that are under this program and all of the forest land classes, from high productivity to lower productivity, and participation rates and all of the assumptions. Is that rate that's indexed the appropriate rate to recapture that? To the extent it's not, then there's a tax break for those people in the program. There's less local revenue for local governments. And to the extent it is, or capturing too much, we have the opposite. Some of the assumptions in this model were that the average, regarding average tax rates, maximum assessed values, what are the acres in the program in these first 4 years of the program, and others. We'll highlight the ones that, talking about acres in the program, the green bars show, and across the bottom are the forest land classes from FA, which is the highest productivity land class, to FX, which is no productivity, and then Eastern Oregon's. And you'll see from the chart that the green is the assumed participation in the model, and that the brown is the actual participation in the model. So what we've observed is that the participation is relatively flat across all classes of productivity, and that the assumption about higher participation in the higher productivity areas was needs adjusted. That assumption about higher participation was key to the actual rate itself and how it was indexed. Again, the goal with this model is to create a revenue-neutral tax over the long term. It was not designed to create a revenue-neutral tax for a particular small tract forest land owner, but across the spectrum of owners in the program. The severance tax is based on volume, harvest volume, by 1,000 board feet, and again, the revenue neutrality goal. Here's the depiction of...
Excuse me, so that it's not based on the value of the timber that's cut. It's based on the board feet.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Here's a depiction of the indexed rate from 2004 in green. So the rate was set at, I don't have that number in front of me, but you can see it's just under $4 per thousand, approximately $3.89 per thousand. Thank you. And then it increased in 2005. This is an indexed rate at 3%. 2006, 2007, 2008, and now when we redid the model, you can see that with the changed assumptions being primarily relative to who participated and in what quality forest land they participated, the results were slightly different and indicating a higher tax rate. Our findings then were that the statutory severance tax rate is within 6% of the rate that was calculated for the 2008 tax year. Most of the differences are coming through the difference between assumed and actual participation and land class. And among the acres, the participation is down 14% in Western Oregon than what was assumed, and it's about equal for Eastern Oregon than what was assumed. What do we do with this information? We concluded that 4 years in a program that assumes that harvest of trees can go from 60 years in Eastern Oregon to maybe 80 years in Eastern Oregon to 60 years in Western Oregon. 4 years is probably not a long enough period of time to determine whether the rate is correct or should be changed from its current index. We recommend that if to get a better handle on it, perhaps we wait until the 10th year and come back and report again. Not that we need more work, want to present more, but it's probably would be better information for decision makers to make a determination. And we believe that the evaluation would be more useful at that time. 6% is equal to roughly $20,000. The difference in the 6% that the rate, the statutory rate, and the rate that we determined, that 6% difference would equal about $20,000 statewide in revenue. So,
thank you.
So based on that, we're open to any questions and further questions or what you would like to see or do.
It does strike me that this is a very complex system for a relatively small revenue source. I'm a little bit curious as to why we went through the exercise in 2003. There must have been a good reason that I simply don't know. You probably don't know it either.
Mr. Chair, I was not directly involved at that time, although she can add anything. Okay. Some of the information I heard was that there was an effort to provide some kind of tax program that would assist small owners, because small woodlands in Oregon are a valued asset. It's something that you decided you wanted, and in your legislative findings, it details the advantages of that. The cash flow issues were a problem. for small owners, they reported. And they worked through a number of interims to try to develop a solution, failed during a number of sessions to come up with a solution, and finally in 2003 this solution was arrived at.
Does it appear that this solution is one that will eventually lead to the participation of most of the small tracts over time? Or is it something that's going to continue to be kind of a niche for 30% of the tracts that qualify?
Mr. Chair, we do not know the answer to that question. We've chatted with small woodland owners before we issued the report as final, and we've chatted with the Department of Forestry about our findings, and we didn't receive any indication. I don't know that question actually came up.
It would also be helpful, I think, to understand the administrative costs for those that do not participate in the program, that are using the alternate method of taxation, so that we can make a comparison. I mean, there's a lot of trade-offs in something like this. I think that I personally agree with the idea that we want to try to keep small woodlots operating, and that the taxation ought to be connected with revenues, that when there's a time of no revenues, there shouldn't be much in the way of taxation. On the other hand, our administrative costs are really high for this program. I think it would be helpful to get a comparison between the alternate program, whatever that is, which I don't quite understand at this point, and then this program too. And then finally, of course, I don't think, unless members request it, that we're going to have another hearing on this, because it's simply too small a revenue source for us to get involved in it, given everything else we have to do this year. But I think it might be helpful if we could get a memo from you that kind of talked about these questions, and perhaps you and I could chat about this a little bit at another time, and that we could distribute to the committee for whatever use the committee might want to make of it. Is there anything else, members, that you have for this presentation? Thank you very much. We appreciate the presentation, also the fact that it is a short period of time since
Absolutely.
2003.
And Mr. Chair, I will follow up with you on a memo.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll get you those answers. And just as a matter of clarification, those administrative costs do not include any county costs, because the counties actually are in an interaction with the small tract forest landowner applications also, and tax help. And I believe one of the county assessors is here today, the president of the association.
Yes, and I wonder if you had some remarks you wanted to make on this report. And if you do, come forward, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Annette Spickard, and I'm the assessor in Lane County, and we have a large number of these accounts in our county, and I'm also the president of the Assessors Association this year. My comments, I would like to echo what Mr. Phillips just told you, is that the administrative costs in the report do not include the costs at the local level for us to administer the program, and so we would appreciate the opportunity to provide additional information if requested to Mr. Phillips, so you can have the big picture of what it does take to administer. The initial application piece is not a major issue for us. What happens is this program has a lot of technicalities around ownership changes, lot line adjustments to the property, that type of thing that take a significant amount of time for us to take care of in order for the person to continue to qualify under the program. I have some previous information from the previous manager of this division at the Department of Revenue, Mr. Norm Miller, who you all may have met in the past. He met with our County Board of Commissioners last fall to talk about this program and industrial forest land, because, as you know, Lane County is one of the impacted counties with the federal forest funding, and they were curious about local taxation on private timberland. And one of the charts he gave, which I can leave here with Mr. Phillips for you, talked about before the small tract forest option was in place the year prior to that, the amount of privilege tax that came to all local governments through the program was roughly $1.1 million. And in the last year of his chart, which unfortunately is 06-07, so it's not very current, but in that fourth year of the new program, the amount of the severance tax that was distributed amongst all the counties was only $290,000. So it has been a significant drop in the amount of tax collected from the severance tax piece, combined with the fact that we can only levy a property tax against 20% of the special value of the land. And so at the local level, they are experiencing a dramatic drop in revenue from these types of properties. So, and another thing to think about is that if someone's disqualified from the program, I believe they're prevented from reapplying for 5 years, and that might be part of what's playing into the participation rate in the program and the delay and how long it takes to build up the number of people in the program. So if you have any particular questions of me, I'd be happy to answer them. I appreciate you letting me have a few minutes to talk to you, but we are interested in what we can provide in the terms of ideas around simplifying administration.
Mr. Chair,
thank you. Yes.
I don't actually know who this is a question for, but I'm just to try to clarify what this program, what these two taxation regimes look like. Is it safe to say that people's behavior, if they're not being taxed until timber is felled and it's produced, is it safe to say under a 20% regime as opposed to a 100% taxation regime that one incentivizes a person cutting down trees and one maybe allows them to have different choices with which to with what to do to their land? Does that make sense? So if you're going to get taxed on 100% value of your land every single year, it seems like you might show up and cut down more trees as to be able to pay off the assessed, pay off that tax. Whereas if you're only being taxed on 20% every year, you might show up and come up with a different, come to a different conclusion. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair, Representative Colt, I think that makes good tax planning sense.
Well, and of course, that was exactly the theory that the committee used in 2003 when this whole plan was adopted. Yeah.
And if I might add, if you're paying 20% and you never harvest, you don't have a tax incidence.
Right.
Yes. Other questions? I want to thank you, Annette, for coming all the way up from Eugene. The members of the committee probably don't know that Annette was my successor on the Eugene School Board when I left the board to join the legislature. And then later she ran for the assessor and won that post. And you're welcome. I expect we'll probably see you other times this session, won't we? Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Other business to come before the committee today? I don't see any. Use your half an hour before session wisely, and we are adjourned until tomorrow.